All right. House Committee on Revenue for March 23rd, 2015 will come to order. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2131. We get to see Mazin again.
Yes. Good to be with you again. House Bill 2131 comes to you from the Municipal Debt Advisory Commission. You have a preliminary SMS on all this, and primarily the bill tries to strengthen the language in the statutes as it comes to revenues and taxes from the local government to be pledged and made as a secure obligation for the bond payments. So that's what, in a nutshell, the bill does. And this time.
All right. And we have Carol, McCoog, and Laura Lockwood McCall. This one I recognize because I recognize Christian names. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Carol McCoog. I'm a partner with the law firm of Hawkins, Stellafield & Wood, and we serve as bond counsel to a number of state agencies as well as numerous Oregon local governments, and I'm currently serving as chair of the Oregon Municipal Debt Advisory Commission. What House Bill 2131 attempts to do is to strengthen the credit of Oregon local governments' general obligation bonds by creating a statutory lien on the taxes received by the local governments under the GO bond levy. In Oregon, local government GO bonds are voter approved and provide for a separate property tax that can be levied outside the limits of Measure 5 and Measure 50 in an amount sufficient to pay debt service on the GO bonds. We have always seen, and the market I think has accepted, that the general obligation bond of an Oregon local government is the strongest credit that they can offer an investor. However, in recent years, there has been some concern across the country, particularly in a fiscal distress situation, about what it means to have a GO bond credit and how secure that is. In the Detroit bankruptcy case, the city of Detroit, in its initial plan, proposed to treat its GO bond holders as unsecured creditors. As you can imagine, the bond insurers challenged that. Ultimately, the bankruptcy case was settled by multiple parties, and that particular point was never fully litigated. Mm-hmm. However, as you can imagine, it created a lot of chatter in the municipal bond community and some concerns with investors as well as bond lawyers and rating agencies. And as we learned from our colleagues that are the bankruptcy experts and bankruptcy academics, that had the GO bond levy and the taxes associated with them a statutory lien, that the challengers' positions in the bankruptcy court may have been stronger. And because of that, it has created a lot of, again, speculation around the country about whether or not having a GO bond credit is as secure as previously thought. Now, in Oregon, local governments, except for two very specific kinds of special districts, cannot declare bankruptcy under Chapter 9. And we are in favor of that landscape, and we support that. But nevertheless, there is still this question that is out there with investors and rating agencies. It's a box they want to check in terms of, you know, how secure GO bonds are. So what we're trying to do is really alleviate any concerns and quell any questions about how strong an Oregon local government GO bond really is by creating this statutory lien on the taxes that are received. By, of course, strengthening the credit of a GO bond, we are lowering borrowing costs for the local governments, and by lowering the borrowing costs, we lower the taxes that taxpayers pay for the debt service on the bonds. So thank you very much, and I'm happy to entertain any questions.
Thank you. Laura.
Laura Lockwood McCall, Director of the Debt Management Division in the State Treasurer's Office.
I serve as a treasurer's representative on the MDAC board, but also wanted to let you know the treasurer's office does support this directly. We were recently part of a state debt management network training program about the Detroit bankruptcy and lessons learned. Moody's suggested that having a statutory lien would be half a notch of credit quality, not a full notch, but half a notch. And so if you had a school district on the margins between, let's say, a AA minus and a AA, this could be one more piece that would help them have a better credit rating. And as Carol said, that will translate into a lower borrowing cost for our school districts. Thank you very much. I should also mention that the state of California is reviewing this exact bill for this exact reason as we speak.
Questions? Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you both for being here and testifying today. You, Laura, started to speak to this, but what's the sense of the national landscape and how different states are treating this situation?
Through the Chair, Representative Davis, there was in this presentation, they had all 50 states with check marks, and not every state has a formal statutory lien. I think in the state of Rhode Island, where they had a bankruptcy situation that, like Carol's talking about, it made a big difference for the community in Rhode Island. Generally, when you're in bankruptcy, the big push-pull is between pension liability mm-hmm. And then the bondholders. And so in the case of Rhode Island, because the state went in and made sure that there was a statutory lien, bondholders did fine in the district. I think it was Central Falls,
yeah.
Was able to come back later into the bond market and restore its credit rating, you know, and move on with investors. I mean, one of the things you lose if it's just a general pledge and you're at the bottom is access to capital. So once lost, it's harder to recover in the future.
Paula?
Yes, please.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for that. It's really helpful. And to clarify, until the Detroit bankruptcy case, would you say nationally both bond rating agencies and bond holders were under the assumption that this was already the case?
Yes, Chair Barnhart, Representative Davis. Yes, that's the case. I think most people assumed that GO bond holders had an absolute lien on the taxes. And in fact, the current statutes do provide for that the taxes that are received would be dedicated to the payment. It's just not that magic language of the lien that I think would hope would be there, and it again allows the investors and the rating agencies to check the box.
Thank you.
Representative Vance,
please. Mr. Chair, so can you describe for us the lien on the levy? Exactly what does the lien attach to?
Representative Benz, Chair Barnhart, the lien is actually on the taxes that are collected from the levy that is levied against the property owners under the GO bond authorization. So the lien is an automatic attachment. It's local government revenues are actually have a statutory exemption from a UCC type lien where you file and there's, you know, some sort of cloud on the title and that whole scheme. Fortunately for us in the municipal context, there's an exemption for that that UCC framework. And so the lien itself is attached immediately to the revenues once received under the statute.
Please, yes.
So what I'm interested in is, first of all, the priority. It should be a lien on the proceeds, then, as opposed to a lien on the levy as such. But I'd be highly interested in knowing the priority of the liens as filed. Is it a sequential thing? Is it first come, first serve? Is everybody all in the same bucket when it comes to this levy? This lien. And then the second one is, if we chose to reduce the amount of the levy from, let's say, 10% to 5%, would those who hold a lien have anything to say about it? So there's two questions there. I apologize.
Sure. Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz, the lien would be a priority lien, a first lien on those revenues that are received, and very likely the only lien that would be pledged and given to the bondholders of those bonds. And should a local government have the opportunity to issue future GO bonds voted upon by the voters of their jurisdiction, I think they would then lien the taxes that are received from that GO bond levy, and those bondholders would have a first lien on the taxes under that levy, if I'm hopefully being responsive to that question.
Thanks, follow-up.
Please. Yes.
Thank you. So the assumption there is that you have a separate levy for each activity, and thus only one opportunity or need to lean it. I was thinking more of a not necessarily there being such a new source of revenue for each new bond issuance. And so perhaps you would look at some income stream that already exists and pledge a portion of it and say, and then go ahead and issue your bond based on the overall property taxes of a city, let's say. Mm. And so I was more making the assumption that we wouldn't have an independent levy for this particular bond. That was the kind of what I had in my mind.
So Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz, yes, indeed, each GO bond that is authorized obtains its own separate property tax levy. And so those bond owners have a right to that stream of taxes that are levied under that GO bond authorization.
If I could add, I think I know where you're headed through the chair. I think in the case you're talking about, Representative Benz, those are limited obligation bonds. A general obligation bond, which where you pledge a full faith and credit, requires that voter approval and that separate levy. Okay. So if you do the kind of bond issue you're talking about, I believe it would be a limited obligation. We are not touching that part of the law.
That's correct.
Only for voter-approved general obligation bonds.
Right. And one last, to go back to the second part of my question, and this may have, there would be no reason then for the taxpayers to go in and modify the amount of the tax imposed to fund the levy. They would have said, okay, it's going to be 2% of something, and then to go back in later and cut it in half. Really, there wouldn't be, I can't think of any reason to do that, but you'd be prohibited from doing it if you already pledged it.
Correct. Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz, that's correct. The GO bond, the voters, typically what they approve is a maximum principal amount of bonds to be issued. So they are approving essentially to pay the debt service on the maximum principal amount of the bonds.
Thank you.
Okay. That makes sense. Representative Whitsitt, please.
So in Detroit, because they didn't have something like this, they were looking at selling the contents of their museum to raise funds to pay off this. So would this prevent something like that from happening, or would that, when you have an obligation to a bond, would that obligate certain things that the state owns or cities own or whatever to be subject to sale to?
You want to take a shot?
Sure.
Through the chair. I'll take a first shot, but I'm going to turn to my lawyer.
Okay.
I think we have to step back and realize the state of Michigan's organizing principles and the authorization of government, local governments to sell GO bonds could be completely different than our own. So not knowing all the specific bonds in the state of Michigan and in the city of Detroit, my guess is they have the ability just to sell general obligation bonds as a city, whether it's with or without voter approval. They were in bankruptcy, and they were trying to reorganize their operating costs, their pension costs, and their debt service costs. And so they were gathering all their different pieces of money to pay bills. In the case of Oregon, we have only voter-approved general obligation bonds with its own separate millage, no independent ability for districts just to sell bonds without that, unless it's a limited obligation bond. And again, let's just say in the worst case, it was the limited bonds that fell apart. Well, we don't have the ability for local governments to file for bankruptcy. That's not to say they wouldn't have to scramble to figure out how to balance their budget, but we don't have the ability in our state at this moment for cities, counties, school districts to go into bankruptcy.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Whitsitt. Yeah, so I think Laura's correct. In that situation, I think there was a massive plan in terms of the city trying to pay all of its bills. And so in that context, they were looking at all of their assets, including a museum, in terms of how to liquidate them and to pay their bills and then putting their plan together. So I think what we're focused on here is simply the GO bond piece of it. And I think for GO bond holders, what we're trying to do is make them feel secure that what they have in terms of the GO bond levy and the taxes produced by the levy it is enough for them, and they wouldn't need to look towards other assets of a local government for payment.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the way the language reads, it says revenues from the levy, blah, 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 on the revenues are pledged as security. So does that mean that everything that's currently outstanding is now secured by such a pledge?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz, that's correct. It would apply to outstanding bonds and the revenues collected under those annual property tax levies to pay the debt service on the bonds as well as bonds going forward. Is that?
Yes, please.
So yeah. I guess the idea is if I was a city right now, I'd zoom around really fast and pledge them someplace else and get ahead of this statute.
Well.
I'm just joking.
Well, except that, of course, if you read A, line 11, revenues collected under this section and earnings on the revenues only to pay the principal of an interest on general obligation bonds. So the city's already, or the public agency's already obligated to use that money only to pay the principal and interest on general obligation bonds now. If I interpret this proposal correctly, you're dealing with the reality that the green eyeshade guys in New York and London have to study statutes from all over the world in order to figure out what they're buying. They like having language like pledged as security in a statute, even though the language we already have probably covers them. It's a little bit like the bill we had just a few days ago when companies were dealing with property tax questions and wondering whether we were going to try to get them somehow. And so they wanted suspenders and a belt and a few other things. This looks like an extra belt to me. Is it any different than that?
Chair Barnhart, I think you're right. The statutory language does dedicate the taxes to the payment, and you're right. We are putting a belt and suspenders on this to create the lien so that the folks who need to check those boxes at the rating agencies and the investors can say, yes, Oregon local government, right. Statutory lien.
And if I could follow up then, what this does is it allows these guys who are trying to do a shorthand review of our law to say, yep, they've got that piece covered. We can lower the interest rate this little bit. Because they've dealt with that issue. I think that's what this bill is about. I don't think it is a substantive change in our law. Do you think it is?
Chair Barnhart, I agree with you. I don't think it's a substantive change in our law.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you so much. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard today on House Bill 2131? I'm not seeing any. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2131. Thank you very much for coming today. Appreciate it. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2127. And is that yours? No. Nope. Oh, here comes Kyle. Okay. Oh, good. Thank you. So, 2127.
Yes. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2127 is the first of three assessor bills we have up. 2128 and 2129 also come from them. And the House Bill 2127, we do have a -1 amendment, which does replace the content of the bill. It's the same idea, but expanded upon, and a few things were taken out. So I can just... describe the -1. I believe that's the one we're going to be discussing.
That makes the most sense, yes.
Okay. So with the -1, House Bill 2127 would require an authorized agent providing closing and settlement services in conveyance of real property to tax-exempt government transferee. In this case, it's going to be the U.S. or state and local governments to withhold and pay to county in which the property is located property taxes on the real property as of the date of the conveyance. And an authorized agent is not required to withhold any of the amount of the property taxes if an authorized agent has provided a written declaration of intent to obtain a certificate issued by the county assessor attesting that all charges against the real property have been paid. There's a language that allows the county clerk to not record a fee title of real property if certificate issued by the county assessor does not accompany an instrument conveying or contracting conveyed a fee title. So that'd be the instrument from the county assessor would be that the property tax are going to be paid. It also requires a person seeking to record an instrument of sale to exempt government transferee to pay to the tax collector an amount of charges against real property or assessor's estimate of the charges. So if they're unknown at the time, the assessor can make their best estimate, and that's what would be required to be paid. Any deficiency would be required to be paid would be constitute a personal debt rather than a lien against the property. The importance of that is if it's a lien against the property and the property is now with the tax-exempt owner, it's you can't really go after the property. So it becomes it'd be collected the same as delinquent personal property. The assessors are required to issue the certificate that was described above. There's some definitional terms, and this would take effect the 91st day following sine die.
Thank you. Doug Schmidt, Mr. Walruff, and Mr. Linhares, please. Gentlemen, long time no see.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom Linhares, and I live at 740 Golden Pheasant Drive in Redmond, Oregon. And I'm here today representing the Oregon State Association of County Assessors, and I have two county assessors with me. Thank you for this opportunity to speak on behalf of House Bill 2127. It addresses a problem that has been longstanding, and hopefully this will provide a fix. As you know, property in Oregon is subject to taxation unless explicitly exempted by statute. And of course, longstanding rule of law, public properties are exempt from taxes. It makes no sense for a government to tax itself. So federal, state, local governments are all exempt from property taxes. In addition, and this may not be something you know, even though the assessment date of property is January 1st for the upcoming fiscal year, July 1 through June 30th, ORS 311-410 makes it clear that whatever the taxable status of the property is on July 1st is the status for the entire year. So if property is taxable on July 1st, it's taxable for the entire year. If it's exempt on July 1st, it's exempt for the entire year. So if a property sells from an exempt owner to a taxable owner on January 1st, we don't prorate the taxes for 50% of the year. It is either taxable or exempt for the entire year. So what the problem that House Bill 2127 is attempting to address is in those cases, and unfortunately it happens all too often, a taxable owner sells a piece of property to an exempt owner, federal, state, local government, with delinquent taxes owing. Those taxes, by law, remain a lien on the property and accrue interest. But because it's now owned by an exempt public body, the county really has no avenue for collection of those taxes. After 3 years, we can't foreclose on the property. So in many cases, these taxes sit on the roll for years and years and years, and those taxing districts that were supposed to have gotten those taxes because they were properly assessed and levied when the property status was taxable haven't received those taxes. So, unfortunately, we have anecdotal evidence, or maybe evidence is too strong a word, anecdotal thinking that some parties are gaming the system, that they kind of do a wink and a nod and say the taxable owner tells a school district or a city or a park district, I'll sell you this piece of property, and I can afford to sell it to you cheaper because there's $10,000 in back taxes that I'm not going to pay, and once you take title of the property, the county can't collect from you, so I'll lower my asking price by $10,000. Anecdotally, we understand that that may be happening. Unfortunately, a lot of times it's incidental or inadvertent. All of last year, I was the interim director of assessment taxation for Wasco County, and we had a case exactly like this. In August, the U.S. Forest Service purchased a piece of property from a taxable owner. The title company actually did their job. And they looked at the record, and they saw that we had disqualified the property from farm use deferral, and had calculated 5 years back taxes, and those taxes were going to be placed on the assessment tax roll the following October. The title company collected from the seller that amount of money and paid that amount of money when the tax bills came out. Unfortunately, the title company didn't realize the existence of ORS 311-410, and because the property didn't sell until August, it was taxable for the 2014-15 year, so we calculated taxes for 14-15, along with some fire patrol per acre assessments. And so the amount of money the title company had collected wasn't sufficient to pay the tax bill. So by then, we had changed the ownership to the U.S. Department of Forestry, so they got the tax bill. So I get a phone call from the U.S. Department of Forestry. We're exempt. We don't have to pay taxes. Well, yes, you do, because the property was taxable on July 1st. It remained taxable for the entire year. So we went back and forth, and there was no easy solution to the problem. So, and I think there'll be some other cases that my colleagues will tell you about. So what House Bill 2127, the way it addresses the problem.
And I take it these were not insignificant amounts of money.
In Wasco County, Chair Barnhart, the amounts were like, I think I've got the amounts down, $7,500.
Okay.
So, I mean, it wasn't a large amount, but for some of the Wasco County
taxing districts. Wasco County's not very large.
That, yes. $7,500 is a lot of money in Wasco County.
Yes. Right.
So what House Bill 2127 does is, first, it sort of puts it upon the escrow agents, either the title company or the attorney who's handling the sale, to tell them and put them on record that it is their responsibility to collect the taxes that are due or may become due in the case of an August sale or a sale between July 1st and when the tax bills are calculated, that it's up to the escrow agents to make sure that those taxes are collected from the seller, from the taxable seller. And therefore, the taxes will be available to be paid by the escrow agent when the tax roll is certified. The second fix is it prohibits a county clerk from accepting a deed transferring title to property from a taxable owner to an exempt owner without a certificate from the county assessor stating that all taxes that are due or will become due have been paid. And the taxes that will become due could be just an estimate. It's similar to a subdivision plat. If a developer wants to record a subdivision plat, that plat cannot be recorded until the assessor and the tax collector have signed off that all taxes have been paid, because otherwise you have 50 lots that are created by this subdivision. We can't very well break the taxes due down amongst those 50 lots. So this would be a similar process, a little bit expedited, but there would be a new form developed by the Department of Revenue called a certificate that we would fill out and sign, that the seller could then take to the title company or the attorney saying, it's okay, actually, excuse me, take to the county clerk's office saying, all taxes have been paid, it's okay to record this deed. The third way is that if for some reason something happens and there's still taxes due when the exempt owner takes possession of the property, then we can go back to the seller and collect those taxes the same way we do business personal property taxes, short of foreclosing on the property. Business personal property tax doesn't have a foreclosure process. It's a personal lien against the owner. So we could go back to the seller and say, you sold this piece of property. There were taxes due. The exempt owner isn't going to pay them, so pay up. So that's in a nutshell, House Bill 2127. Unfortunately, it happens far too often, and we're just trying to put some more tools in our toolbox to collect the taxes that were properly assessed and levied on behalf of the county, city, school districts, and special districts throughout the state. Thank you very much, and I would be willing to answer any questions. And again, we have two county assessors who can speak more directly to the kinds of situations that occur.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Good afternoon. My name is Randy Wolf. I'm the Multnomah County Assessor and Tax Collector. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. Tom covered this really well. I'm available for questions, but I do want to relate to you one story that is quite a bit of money. As you may or may not know, cemetery property held for future burial purposes is exempt. That's under 307-150. 307-155 says that if they cease to intend to use that for future burial purposes, the property becomes taxable, and there's a 10-year clawback. So we became aware of in 2011 that a cemetery in Portland had for several years been trying to market their property, looking at developing it, and so forth. And my staff was in the process of calculating the taxes to cancel it. Well, after July 1st, the property transferred. It first transferred to a trust and then it transferred to a municipal corporation, the city. We levied the tax, and typically when property transfers to the municipal corporations after July 1st, they usually pay the tax. Sometimes they don't, but they usually do. The statutes contemplate that government would pay taxes on property, taxes that were appropriately levied. So what happened here was we sent the tax bill to the municipal corporation, the city, and then they appealed it, and through negotiations, it turned out they brought the point, well, you can't collect it. So why are you trying? And they're right. I cannot foreclose on the property. I have no enforcement mechanism. So this property tax is $2 million. It's now sitting on the tax roll accumulating interest, and it's now up to $1 million in interest. So if this bill had been in place, hopefully the escrow agent that closed the transaction, we would do a little outreach education on this. The potential additional tax message is on our tax roll. The escrow agent can see it. It's like farm deferral, all these other deferrals. The message is out there. They would have contacted us, and we would have said, oh, yeah, here's the form. We'll sign off on this, and then you can submit it with the tax, and you can, you know, pay the tax. And then if it escapes all that, like after July 1st, as Tom mentioned, even with subdivisions, we have to estimate taxes for people because we don't have the calculations yet. So we try to estimate, and usually most of the times we estimate a little higher than we can issue a refund to the person that paid the tax. But the last part of this allows us, if we estimate a little low, just like with subdivisions, then we send them a bill for the difference. And then they usually pay it. And if not, then just like business personal property, we start collection efforts. And that's what I have for this today, and welcome to answer any questions, any of the three of us.
Thank you.
I'll defer to Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Doug Schmidt, Polk County Assessor. I'll defer to them. I do have an example. It's a few thousand dollars of a developer transferring part of a property to the city. City won't pay, but the back taxes are sitting out there.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, Representative Smith Warner, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for bringing this, for speaking to us about this. It's interesting. I'm just trying to get a sense of why we need this in particular versus how these real estate transfers work now, because my understanding, and I always try to compare it to, okay, so, you know, when my husband and I bought our house, if we had had any liens against or sold our last house, if we had had any liens against our house, we would have had to, the title company, that is their job to find those things and then to make sure that they are paid for before the transfer takes place. So I guess I'm a little unclear as to what this will change that, I mean, aren't the title companies doing this already? And if so, why not?
Chairman Barnhart, Representative Smith Warner, Randy Wolf, Multnomah County. My example, it did not happen. And in going back and looking at the documents and the transactions, it appeared there was a contemplation of property taxes. But our office was never contacted. The message was out there, and the taxes were not paid, and they're sitting out there right now. Hmm.
So well, if I can, please go ahead, follow up.
Yeah, I was just going to say briefly. So, is the assumption that if there were when there is an actual lien for past due, this is working, or it's happening? But the problem is the projecting forward.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Smith Warner, I think what you're looking at is a residential purchase. The title company identifies all the liens on the property, and you say all these have to be cleared up before I will take possession of that property. If this is moving to a non-assessable owner, like a municipal corporation, a city, whatever, they may say, we don't care. We don't care that those back taxes or those liens are out there because they can't foreclose on them. So I think it's a little bit different situation. Where you want it cleared up.
Yeah, describe the difference for a taxable new owner as compared to the non-tax.
Well, the taxable new owner would assume.
I think that's what she's aiming for.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, again, from what I understand, a taxable owner acquiring the property assumes all those liens and penalties and taxes. So you would assume those taxes if they weren't settled at closing, where on a non-assessable tax-exempt owner, we can't really collect those, so they don't really care if there's back taxes sitting out there. Now, that's just my assumption.
Well, Chair Barnhart, Representative Smith, in the Wasco County case, if that would have been from a taxable seller to a taxable buyer, the title company probably would have estimated taxes for the upcoming year and included that in the credit and debits between the buyer and seller. I think what happened, I never did talk to the title company, but they just assumed that since it was being sold to the U.S. Department of Forestry, that there wouldn't be a tax bill in 1450. So it was an error on their part. If it's a taxable owner, then they would have known that there was going to be a tax bill, and they would have collected amounts accordingly. But because it was going from – so I think that's the difference. I think some title companies aren't aware of 311.410 that says whatever the status is July 1st, that's the status for the whole year. They just assume, oh, if it's going to an exempt owner, there won't be a tax bill for 2014-15. But in this case, there was. I think maybe that's part of the difference. And plus – when you're talking about a municipal corporation, I think it perhaps may be more likely that those transactions don't go through title companies.
I'm sorry. Would you repeat that last sentence?
I think if it's a transaction to an exempt owner, a municipal corporation, it is more likely that the transaction would not go through a title company. It's just
hence the assessor's certificate being really important.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much.
From this bill.
Yes.
I was trying to figure out why you wanted that. Now I understand. Representative Vance, are you finished? Sorry.
Thank you.
Representative Vance, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just, this may be answered by the last exchange, but in lines 15 through 20, it indicates that the authorized agent doesn't have to do this if the person who has conveyed or contracted to convey has provided a written declaration of intent to obtain. I don't understand. It looks like a doorway everybody could run through. Why is that there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Betts, where are you? 15, 16 line. What page?
Page 2, I think.
Of the Dash 1 amendments?
Dash 1 amendments. Yes, in Section 1, the very end, just above Section 2, lines 15 through 20.
On page 2.
Oh, page 2.
I think what that says is if the title, because normally the title company accounts for taxes between the buyer and seller. They prorate between the buyer and seller. But if the seller comes in with a certificate from the assessor's office saying all the taxes have already been paid, then there's nothing to prorate.
Follow up?
Yes, please.
Yeah, that's not what it says, though. It says has provided to the authorized agent written declaration of intent to obtain the certificate.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, I see where you're seeing a loophole in or intends, in the language or intends. That's that is a loophole.
Looks like it.
Sorry, let's work from the end. Representative Whitsitt, did you have something?
I was just wondering if there is a typical situation which results in or is the result of one of these sales or conveyances. I mean, when you're talking about something going to the federal government, are these typically sales from NGOs or something to the federal government? Is this eminent domain? Is it what is the typical situation that you see where something ends up going to the federal government? Because it's sort of unusual for private property to end up being sold to the federal government, it seems like. No?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Whitsitt, Randy Wall from Montgomery County. We have situations where the federal government, the Forest Service, is purchasing property up in the Columbia River Gorge and other situations very similar. And they can purchase buildings, not that tax is rolling, but they recently purchased property out near the Port of Portland for a large security building. And so there's a number of transactions going on.
I was just wondering how often this happens that we need this bill. Do you have a cumulative number of how often this has happened?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Whitsitt. No, I don't have that at the moment. We could always do a data draw and find out how often it transfers. To me, $2 million, of which the school district didn't receive their $400,000 or $500,000, is a lot of money to me. So I don't need very many examples to have one really hit me upside the head.
Actually, it's probably more like $800,000.
It could be. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah. One of the things about the assessors, of course, is that they don't want any transactions to go through that didn't follow the normal course of things. and that's what we pay them for, to do it, to behave that way. Representative Davis, please.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you very much for your testimony. Interesting issue. I'm looking at the sort of opportunities provided in the bill, the dash ones, to fix the problem. It seems to me there are kind of three simultaneously. One is the imposition of a new requirement on escrow agents, the imposition of a new requirement potentially on attorneys, and then there's also the certificate option that we mentioned, not being able to record either the deed or land sale contract or conveyance instrument. It seems to me that the final one alone could potentially solve the issue, as opposed to trying to figure out methods by which we would require what are supposed to be independent third parties, escrow agents and closing attorneys, to withhold funds of a potential client. Simply saying you're not allowed. You as the assessor have to issue a certificate before a deed could be recorded. That places the onus, it would seem to me, on the seller then to pony up the cash. So I'm just thinking of if there's a more direct way to get at this.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Davis. To your question there, yes, it's a three-prong approach, and it's really about education to begin with. Anytime escrow agents, attorneys are closing transactions, they look for, as Mr. Linares noted, taxes outstanding, potential additional taxes. I'm called all the time, my staff is, by agents closing farm and forest deferral properties. Potential tax messages out there because they're getting ready to issue title insurance. We're not in those offices, so we don't know the climate of when it is being transferred to a tax-exempt entity, what is happening. So this doesn't provide any penalties against the attorneys or the closing agents. It's more like, hello, knock on the door. Mm-hmm. Could you please start paying attention to this? And by the way, when you go to record your deed, there's a certificate required, because what we really want to do is, as you just noted, the seller's there. These agents or attorneys are holding their money now. So as they're doing that, but once the disbursement's made, if we didn't have these first two steps and we just relied on the third step, which is for a deficit, then we're trying to find money that perhaps has left the state, isn't here. So that's the last stopgap. And I hope I answered your question there.
Yeah, follow up. Just more of a comment. In the closings I'm a part of, the cash is not released until the deed's recorded. So the money would still be there in, I think, 100% of the closings that I've been a part of. There's the recording of the deed, then the transfer of the cash, sort of the drug exchange, right? Who gets the cocaine? Who gets the money? We always require the money first before the...
you've used it in escrow.
That was the example in law school they gave me, and I always go back to.
You've used the escrow agent, though, in all those cases, haven't you, Representative?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think they have transactions. I think they testify they have transactions that sometimes doesn't have a third party in the middle like that. Let me ask a question. Were there other questions? I have one, if no one else does. Do you want time to take another look at the line 19, page 2, written declaration of intent to obtain a certificate, to see whether you might want to have something different there?
Mr. Chair, that might be helpful. We certainly want to address Representative Bence's concern. We want the bill to be as workable as possible. If you wouldn't mind. It shouldn't take us more than a day or two to put our heads together.
We don't have a schedule for work today anyway, so that's one of the reasons for not doing that. We don't get tempted to move out a bill that's not ready. Other questions? Is there anyone else who wants to be heard today on House Bill 2127? If not, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2127. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2128. And I think you're still it, aren't you? You might as well stay right there.
Okay, Mr. Chair, House Bill 2128 also comes to us from the assessors. It establishes personal liability of a lessee for property taxes related to property leased from tax-exempt U.S., state, or local government owner, provides counties with means of collecting unpaid taxes from person and person's real and personal property. It requires the county clerk to immediately issue writs of attachment on application by the tax collector or district attorney for the county as a plaintiff, and applies to property tax years beginning on or after July 1st, 2015.
Okay. Gentlemen.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, my name is Tom Linhares. I live at 740 Golden Pheasant Drive in Redmond, Oregon, and I'm here today representing the Oregon State Association of County Assessors. Excuse me. House Bill 2128 is similar to the last bill that you just heard, but this involves properties where the exempt owner, federal, state, local government, owns property and leases it to a taxable entity. And therefore, the property is taxable. This goes on for a year, 2 years, 3 years. The lease expires. The lessee moves out. The exempt owner regains possession of the property, but the taxable owner, who was supposed to be paying the taxes, didn't. So now we are same situation. We have an exempt owner, delinquent taxes owing, interest accruing. The tax collector cannot collect the money, and the tax collector can't foreclose on the property when there's 3 years of delinquent taxes. So this, what 2128 says, is that in those situations, we go back to the lessee, the taxable lessee, who incurred, in a sense, incurred the tax liability because it was their taxable status that made the property taxable. And we, the county, could then collect the taxes as a personal liability of that lease, taxable lessee, and sort of circumvent the fact that we can't collect the taxes from the exempt owner. And this happens a lot of times with port districts. Port districts are very, very active in leasing property for industrial use, airport hangars, that sort of thing. And generally, the lease agreements are triple net, such that the lessee is responsible for paying the taxes. And so we get copies of those leases. The property tax bill goes out, port of whatever, in care of the taxable owner, taxable lessee gets the property tax bill. And I don't know if they do this on purpose, but they may say, well, my lease expires in 6 months. I'm gone. I'm not going to pay the taxes. Anecdotally, we think that's happening. So similar to the last bill, but slightly different situation, but they both come down to the fact that when an exempt owner owns property with delinquent taxes, the county has very few tools in which to collect those taxes on behalf of the county, cities, school districts, and special districts.
Representative Leininger, please.
Thank you. Well, as a former county commissioner and big fan of Bob Vroman, tax assessor for Clackamas County, I think both of these bills are really exciting. I'm wondering if you can speak to all right. You know, I'll just put it out there.
You definitely belong on this committee.
That's just who I am. So now that we've cleared that up, do you have an estimate of how much county resource, you know, how much resource that the assessors could be collecting that is foregone for want of this kind of provision in 2128? And even though we've closed the public hearing on the other, I would love to know if you have an estimate, the aggregate loss, you know, statewide, maybe annually on 2127 too.
Mr. Chair, Representative Leininger, I'll pass along your compliments to County Assessor Vroman from Clackamas County, and we will make every effort to get that information.
Thanks.
All right, good. Representative Davis.
And thank you. And my apologies for referencing the prior bill, but this was actually the approach I was going to also suggest for the last bill. The person who actually owed the tax maybe should have to pay it, as opposed to us attorneys. Gosh, I'm just shucking for my own here. and escrow agents. But I like the approach of going to the party who owed the taxes.
Great. Representative Vance, please. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was just looking at the language from line 17 through 25, which looks to me like to be just a slight bit overreaching. Having done a lot of provisional process work, almost every piece of those provisional process statutes, since those who use them are acting in anticipation of getting a judgment, they don't have a judgment yet. Mm-hmm. So nothing has been done to say the amount or anything else. So we're basically taking it for granted that everything is perfect. That's why we're not asking you either to get an affidavit or to file an undertaking, which is a bond. So if you do something wrong and you ruin their life, there's no bond there for us to pursue. So why those particular protective elements of the provisional process statute are being taken out? In perhaps in the old days, before we had all of the broke counties, we could say, well, there's no problem. If you do something wrong, we can sue the county and get the money back. Not necessarily true in some of our counties today. So I would just wonder why we're taking those pieces out.
Mr. Chair, Representative Betts, quite honestly, I can't answer the question. I'll just be quite frank with you. I'm not real familiar with this process. Randy, does that make more sense to you?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Bentz. I have to apologize. I'm having a hard time tracking your question right now.
Representative Bentz, do you want to?
Yeah, let me do a follow-up. Yeah. If you just go to line 19, and what it says is, it says the county shall, actually, line 18, the county shall have the benefit of all the laws of this state pertaining to provisional remedies. That's the provisional process. Against real and personal property of the person who owes the taxes without the necessity of filing either an affidavit or an undertaking. Undertaking is a bond. And the next paragraph continues. I'm guessing that whoever crafted this said, well, it's a county. The county's never going to do anything wrong. A county's always going to be right that the taxes are perfect. And if the county screws up and ruins somebody's life by grabbing their pickup truck so they can't get to work or take the child to the doctor, there won't be any reason to have a bond because they can sue the county for the damages. That's why the undertaking has been taken out. These are all my assumptions on reading that language. So I would just say that seems to be overreaching, at least the way I look at it, but perhaps there's some good justification for it.
Representative Barnhart, Representative Bentz, this language was all taken right from the same statutes that we use for business personal property, and I hopefully, as the same one, there will be a work session, and we can come back and answer that question more specifically with you, because I did not bring my attorney with me that wrote this and worked with legislative counsel. The second B there talks about the same process we take is that we, upon delinquency, we actually record a warrant, and then we can issue writs. And so our process is November 15th, the taxes are due. December 15th, when they're 30 days delinquent, we record a warrant. And then the process is we can go and record that warrant in any county we choose to where we believe that they have real property. So in the end, we can collect delinquent personal property taxes in any county and attach it to real property that people own. And so I could get you a little bit better answer for that at the work session.
Follow up. Yes, please.
So I don't know how the current law reads, but this is real and personal property, so the pickup truck would be on the table, so as opposed to land, which is considerably different. So if that's the way it is currently, then I'm not suggesting we change it because somebody else has already thought it through, but if it's new, then it certainly needs attention.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Bentz, I will clarify that this is no different a treatment than business personal property, which we've been using for a number of years.
You will clarify means you'll check again.
Yes, I will.
Sir. Thank you. That, just make sure I understood. The key piece of this is this line 7, isn't it? In addition to being a lien on the real property, are a personal liability of the person whose property interest in the real property gives rise to taxation under. That's the key to the whole bill, isn't it?
Representative Bernhardt, yes, that is. That's the key, and I will give you one example of a situation that occurred with us about 2 years ago. What happens when property exempt by ownership is leased? We set up what we call an A1 account. It's called that because we don't set up a personal property account because it's technically not personal property. It's a real property interest. Well, a couple attorneys rented office space from the federal government. We sent them the bill, and they came in and they told us, we're not going to pay this bill. And we said, well, why not? And they said, because you can't foreclose on us. The property's not taxable. So through a lot of maneuvers and everything, we ended up getting them to agree to pay the tax. But that is where this first came to illustrate to me. We have an issue. And
while Tom agreed to try to get an aggregate number, I think it's going to be very hard to do that because there are stories that occur and occur, and you just don't aggregate that type of information. I know I could run a data draw out of my roll and find out how much delinquent taxes we have and who's the owner and could get that kind of information. But again, it's back in the same scenario as the last time. We need a property tax system that is going to work equitably and fairly for all the taxing districts. So if it happens once, it can happen twice, and it can happen many more times. Thank you.
Thank you. I was going to ask how would you enforce the taxation on a lien interest of this kind now? I have a 20-year lease. I'm in year five. I haven't paid the taxes. How do you, without this bill, how do you enforce them? How do you get me to pay? Can you?
Chair Barnhart, I do not know of any. Only the real property security for real property taxes under our current statutes.
And you've already said you can't foreclose because the property actually belongs to some government.
That's correct.
Okay. Representative Wetzel, please.
So I was just wondering if, for example, on our green energy, solar, and wind farms, if they are placed on federal or state government, which isn't otherwise being taxed, they are leasing, I assume, these properties. Do they pay taxes then on the land that would otherwise not be taxed? Is that what you're saying?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Witsit, you're correct. Most of the value, however, is on the improvement, the wind tower, the solar panel. But there is a small amount of land that is sort of broken off from the larger piece and assessed directly to the taxable entity that's leasing the land and has built the tower. But most of the value is in the tower, not the quarter acre piece of land that it sits on.
Other than the solar, some of the solar farms are fairly substantial in size. And so I just wanted to clarify that they are supposed to be paying taxes then, even if they have, is it only if they have a certain lease agreement with the federal government or state government, or is it if they have these facilities placed on them?
Representative Barnhart, Representative Witsit, it comes down to how the lease is written, but generally the leasee is responsible for paying the taxes because they have possession of the property, sole possession. They're usually paying a pretty good chunk of money to lease that property, and so the property is taxable to the leasee. So in that case, we'd probably have two accounts, one just for the land, exempt owner in care of taxable leasee, and then the improvements, which is owned outright by the leasee, a separate account assessed directly to the taxable leasee.
Just one more question. So are they taxed as industrial properties then? Or what is the tax status of the renewable energy? Yeah, go ahead.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Witsit. The taxable value for the underlying property is its real market value. So generally the situations that you're talking about, we're talking rural areas, mm-hmm. So typically it'll be a minor amount. And I know that's hard to characterize that. As an example, the cemetery property I talked about, our value per acre was somewhere in the $13,000 per acre because we basically appraised it as open space. Mm-hmm. So if it's very valuable industrial ground within the city, that'd be a lot different. So number one, it's back to what's the high and best use of the property as vacant, considering all governmental restrictions. So the situation that you're talking about, generally that property is of much lower value, typically open space, various values like that. Why I hesitated to jump in on that is when we start talking about solar properties and all these other energy incentives, there's a number of programs out there that I didn't come prepared to talk about that each situation would be unique that could change the landscape of any situation we're talking about. And I do have some follow-up on the previous question about the warrants. Due to one of our colleagues back here, Mr. Phillips, he found the statute is 311-455, Representative Vince, regarding the language that's used in House Bill 2128 that we said we would follow up on.
And the language is the same?
Yes.
Right. Okay. Thank you. So, Representative Vince.
Thank you. So we've always been overreaching in me.
Not a question.
No answer required.
Thank you. Other questions for on this bill? Okay, with that, is there anyone else who would like to be heard today on House Bill 2128? Seeing none, that we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2128. Open public hearing on House Bill 2129.
Okay.
Oh, and you can stay right there.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2129 is the third assessor bill we have up today and the most exciting, I think, as well. It allows the taxpayer to petition the county assessor for correction of maximum assessed value of property for the current tax year upon demonstrating that the new property or improvement to the property added to the roll in the prior tax year did not exist as of the assessment date. It requires the assessor to correct maximum assessed value of property for current tax year in the manner determined by the assessor, and the correction must reflect removal of the new property or the improvements. It requires the property constitute an integral part of any land or improvements that has continuously been in existence since the prior tax year and was not included in the assessment of prior tax years to be considered new property or new improvements to the property. It applies to property tax years beginning on or after July 1st, 2015. And it's just a note, this bill may sound a little familiar. We worked a bill earlier last month, House Bill 2487, that covered some of the same how to add property maximum assessed, or how to remove property, or maximum assessed value related to square footage that doesn't necessarily exist. So of a house that was maybe at 2,500 square feet, but there's actually only 2,300 square feet. So there is some overlap between the two bills, and there is some also differences. It's not the exact same language. I think it's just like to highlight just a couple of differences is in the case of 2129, the assessor shall correct maximum assessed value, where in 2487 it was may, so the assessor has some discretion on how to choose to go forward there. But in House Bill 2129, as compared to 2487, in 2487, how to correct maximum assessed value was prescribed in statute, whereas in House Bill 2129, the discretion is then on how the assessor will make the change in a manner determined by the assessor. So they have a little discretion on, I guess, the secondary side rather than up front. But just so you're aware, there's another bill that does relate a little bit to the same issue.
Very good. Gentlemen.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, thank you. My name is Tom Lindhares. I live at 740 Golden Pheasant Drive, Redmond, Oregon, and I'm here today representing the Oregon State Association of County Assessors. House Bill 2129 is being submitted for your consideration to allow changes in the maximum assessed value of property under 1997's ballot measure 50. And if you will, if I could give just a two-minute description of ballot measure 50, that might be helpful. Measure 50 established three sets of values for each property. Some properties actually have more than three, but we won't go there. Real market value, maximum assessed value, and assessed value, with assessed value being simply the lower of either market value or maximum assessed value. Maximum assessed value was first established in 97 as the 95 real market value of the property less 10%, and then beyond that, maximum assessed value can only go up 3% a year. Market value can do whatever it does based on sales in the area. There's some other exception value that can increase maximum assessed value more than 3%. If a new property comes on the roll, then the maximum assessed value is established for that first year, and then beyond that, it can only go up 3% a year. So what you have to understand is market value fluctuates by the market. Maximum assessed value doesn't really track with market value. Market value can go up 20%. Maximum assessed value goes up 3%. Market value can come down 20%. Maximum assessed value still goes up 3%. So it acts independently. We won't go into the situation where market value falls below the maximum assessed value. That gets a little weird. My point is, in the original version of Measure 50, both the constitutional language and the implementation bill in 97, in no case, let me repeat that, in no case was there an allowance for maximum assessed value to be reduced. It just wasn't conceived of. So as we've implemented Measure 50, and we've gone along since 97, there have been numerous cases where it doesn't make sense that we shouldn't be allowed to reduce maximum assessed value. It's in the best interest of the property owner, but the Constitution and the statutes don't provide for it. So there are now, currently in statute, some provisions for reducing maximum assessed value, mostly because assessors in the Department of Revenue have come to the legislature and asked for authority to reduce the maximum assessed value in certain limited cases. So House Bill 2129 is just sort of a progression, continuation of that process of fine-tuning what was, in my opinion, a flawed aspect of Measure 50, that it didn't anticipate any occasion where maximum assessed value should be reduced. So in this case, what we're addressing is three different situations, and Kyle's already gone over them. The first is when it is brought to the assessor's attention that the square footage of a property is incorrect. A house was built 5 years ago. Again, when property is first brought on the roll, that's the first time the maximum assessed value is calculated. And then every year after that, it's increased 3%. So the property owner comes into the assessor and says, your records indicate my, and I'll use Kyle's square footage, your records indicate that my house is 2,500 square feet. It's only 2,300 square feet. And the assessor goes, my apologies, we made a mistake. We'll reduce your real market value, but we can't reduce your maximum assessed value. Or at least we couldn't until the statute was changed just a couple years ago. So, but when the statute was changed a couple years ago, the reduction in maximum assessed value was based on the prorated a ratio of the change in square footage. So whatever 2,300 divided by 2,500 is, that was the percentage reduction in the maximum assessed value. As we've implemented that statute, it didn't make sense because not all square footages are equal. Basements are worth less than the main floor. Second stories are worth less than the main floor. So it resulted in some screwy calculations of maximum assessed value. So what 2129 says is the assessor can reduce maximum assessed value if there's an error in the square footage, but let the assessor determine the best way of getting to what the correct maximum assessed value should be. That may be going back 5 years, sort of estimating what the, or not estimating, calculating the new market value back 5 years ago, calculating the maximum assessed value that should have been calculated based on the correct square footage, and then increasing that 3%. There might be a whole variety of different ways of doing it. The assessor is best able to determine based on this particular situation. The second thing, which is new, is what we found is sometimes assessors make mistakes. Bob Vroman doesn't make mistakes. But other counties do. And so, again, an appraiser was out to a property five years ago. They picked up a new house, and they picked up an outbuilding, a 30 by 40 shop building. But 5 years later, it's determined that shop building was on the neighbor's property, not that particular property. Okay, again, we can reduce the market value. Sorry, Mr. or Mrs. Property Owner, we can't reduce the maximum assessed value. It just makes absolutely no sense that the maximum assessed value, which generally speaking is also the assessed value and is therefore the value used to calculate a tax bill, it doesn't make any sense not to be able to reduce it. So what happens is that person, that property owner, ends up paying taxes forever on property that didn't exist. It just doesn't make any sense. It's not fair. It's not equitable. And it's really tough to try to explain to a property owner why, we can reduce your market value, but your tax bill isn't going to go down. So the second change would be to allow for a reduction in the maximum assessed value for property that the assessor had on the roll previously, but in fact never existed. The third change is the reverse of that. 5 years ago, the appraiser went out, picked up a new house, didn't see that there was a 30 by 40 outbuilding on the property. 5 years later, okay, we've discovered that the outbuilding is there. We add it to the market value. We can't increase the maximum assessed value. So again, that property's tax bill is based on an incorrect inventory. So that outbuilding, which is now part of the market value, but isn't part of the maximum assessed value, doesn't pay taxes and won't pay taxes forever. So the whole essence of House Bill 2129 is kind of whittle it down to a nutshell, is property that doesn't exist shouldn't pay taxes, and property that does exist should pay taxes. And unfortunately, under the current system, that isn't always the case. And it's just not fair to the citizens of Oregon that a property tax system would allow non-existent property to be taxed and existent property to not be taxed. So we're trying to fix that. And based on these three changes, we think it makes a vast improvement to ballot measure 50. So thank you very much. I'd be happy to answer any questions. And we do have my written testimony on OLIS does have a real simple example of all three of these changes, and we'll have some real life examples from the two county assessors that are here to testify today.
Great. Representative Whitsitt?
I assume there wouldn't be retroactive taxes if you've overlooked something.
I'll answer.
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Whitsitt, that's actually an excellent question. There is a provision for going back and collecting back taxes, but that's existing statute, and there's sort of a narrow window of opportunity to do that. This would be, but the change that 2129 makes is strictly going forward. There wouldn't be a payback provision under this new language.
Okay. Other questions? Representative Leininger, please.
Thanks. Well, I just wanted to get it on the record that I find this bill really exciting also. And anytime you're getting teased as being super nerdy by members of the Revenue Committee, then you know it's a real problem.
Thank you. Other questions? Did either of you have additional comments you wanted to make?
Yes.
Please, go ahead.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Brandy Wolf, Multnomah County Assessor and Tax Collector. I won't repeat what Tom said. He gave you a good overview of it. But his theme that we've been saying in the assessor circles is non-existent property should not be taxed forever, and existing property should not escape taxation forever. And to me, that's what the core of this bill is about. I can tell you a number of stories. I have supervisors back in my office with file folders of situations that they're ready to fix for taxpayers, but they cannot. And this is truly a Measure 50 issue. The current statutes allow us every year to put the right market value on property, but then there's those MAV calculations that Tom talked about. This is prospective going forward, not retrospectively. We already have omitted property statutes that say we can go out and add property to omitted property and all these different rules for going back. But this involves property that the courts have said you've already seen. I'll give you one example. I had an appraiser, and we appraise a lot of properties, and we knock on doors. We ask to get into the properties. We ask to walk around if we can, if someone's home, but many times gates stop us. So in 94, we had a property that it had added a big addition in the backyard. We were out there in 98. We didn't get in the backyard. We can show in our records that we've never appraised this big addition to the house. We found it in 2005, and we sent out the notice, and then the taxpayer appeals and says, wait, I checked the records. They have a very good attorney. You've already been there, and you can't pick that up. And the judge agrees. We can raise the market value. But what should have been the taxes attributable to that, which my appraiser could not get in the backyard and see, escape taxation forever. We're not asking to go back any number of years. Just let's get it right going forward. Other times, it's called appraiser valuation judgment. That's what all these are called. We have homes on sides of hills. It's very hard to climb up and down those hills, especially when it's raining. And that doesn't happen in Oregon. We found out this winter. But you get the plans. And they decide to take that third floor below grade and finish it all out. But that's done after the fact, after the builder got it signed off on it and everything. We can't see it later on. A sale occurs. We get into the property. We get other information. It's there. But the appraiser had already been there. And so without having to see the interior of the property, we're held to the standard that, well, maybe you should have known. I don't know what they're thinking, but that property escapes taxation forever. Then the reverse happens. The appraiser thought that the basement was finished.
our rules and statutes say that that's an appraiser valuation judgment, and then later on we discover it's not. There's not a basement. It's not finished there. We can change the market value, but we cannot correct the MAV. This bill allows us to add some sense of fairness to measure 50 prospectively moving forward. And then finally, on the square footage error, we had the previous bill, 2487. It used the language may, and a lot of my assessor colleagues are a little upset about this one being shall. We can live with either one, but what we like about shall is it says you shall do something. But what it does is why it says in a managed determined by the assessor, because as Tom alluded to, all square footage is not created equal, and when we go out on a property, we get the value right. So when the appraiser was there last time, maybe they got the square footage wrong, and that map should be checked, changed too. But there could be other corrections. So we want the determination to be the component of the value change specifically to the square footage change. So Tom testified, all square footage is not created equal, but there'd be other reasons why we go out there. So this would all be very transparent in the records of the assessor. We have no motivation to not get it right. Thank you.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I'm not quite as energetic as Randy, but I'm going to try and give you a couple of examples. On the square footage issue, I ran a comparison in our system of a 2,200 square foot house with 700 feet in a finished attic. We were notified that the attic was 200 feet smaller. If we looked at just the square footage difference, it would be a 9.1% reduction in MAV. But if it was by the value, it would be a 4.3% reduction. And since MAV is created based on the market value of a property when it's first put on the roll, it seems logical that we should be able to adjust it based on the change in market value, not the square feet. So that's a very simple how the square footage would give a larger adjustment in MAV than what was actually warranted. Second example of a non-existent property. We did manage to fix this one, luckily, but this last year an appraiser in my office went out, picked up an apartment complex, and inadvertently added in some extra units to the tune of $2 million. So needless to say, when they got their tax bill, they called, and we were able to fix it. But if they would not have questioned that in that first year when that value came on the tax roll, then because there was nothing in our records to show that it was a clerical error or anything like that, we couldn't take that value off the roll. So that's an example of how we can make a mistake and add on existing property that isn't there. Then on the inverse of that would be as if he had made a mistake the other way and didn't add that $2 million of apartment value in. The courts have held that it's just an undervalue. It's not an omitted property. It's undervalued, even though the Constitution and the statutes say that the assessor shall add value anytime they find that there is something that's been omitted from the roll. So we're just asking for clarification to add this on as new improvement from this point forward, whenever we find something that has been left off of the tax roll. There's a lot of situations where we may not be able to see a property. We've been to the property.
Representative Davis,
please. I'll wait till it does.
Oh, yeah. No, I was just saying, there's a lot of different situations. Locked gates, we show that we've been to the property, but we haven't actually seen the whole property. If we miss something, the court could say, sorry, you were there, and we can't pick it up. So this just would allow us the next time we're out there and we find it, we can pick it up. Or if we've added it in incorrectly, that we can fix that too. So it's kind of going both ways.
Thank you. Representative Davis?
Thank you, Chair, and thank you all for your testimony on this. I suppose I'm going to make a comment and then a question. First, this seems like a philosophy class, which is great. It's exciting. about what exists and what doesn't exist, but to the extent that the intent of Measure 50, however much folks may like or dislike it, is to lock in stone, so to speak, maximum assessed value. Some of the discussion we're having, especially concerning whether or not a finished addition should have been added to MAV strikes me as coming quite close to just saying assessors should have the ability at some point to prospectively revalue MAV to real market value. So I guess the point is, and the question, here's the question, what constitutes new property or omitted property as to opposed to simply a dispute about the value of maximum assessed versus real market value?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Davis, Randy Wharf. The last page of the bill, 3A, details it, and I think the important part is 3A, big C, little B. I'm not good with some of this stuff. The following is evidence that the property was not included in the assessment of the land or improvements for a prior tax year. A, there's no express reference, that's line 36, the last page, to the property in the records of the assessor. And B, the assessor's valuation of the land or improvements of which the property is an integral part increases as a result of inclusion of the property in the assessment. For the most part, every section in this state uses a computerized assisted mass appraisal system. We have all the characteristics. I can go back numerous years and show you the characteristics for those properties and how the values were calculated. I go out there and I pick up the addition in the backyard. I can specifically show you all the differences and the changes in value. And if that had been picked up as a Measure 50 exception event, and that's what happens today. In this case is limited to where the appraiser had been there and for some reason didn't capture it in their records, whether they didn't see it or something, but they did not appraise it. If we had not been there and they built it and we discover it today, the current statute allows us for omitted property to go back 6 years because that's an exception event under 308.149 when property is first taken into consideration as omitted property. The courts have held, and I don't believe that this was contemplated in the constitutional amendment or when the statutes for implementing Measure 50 was implemented, that if the appraiser was there, it's not omitted. We saw the property. I have various levels of inspections, ones, twos, and threes, and one is simply driving down the street and looking from the street and saying, the property's still there. No, it doesn't look like there's anything to do. My appraisers, I have 24 residential appraisers, and they need to do 30,000 accounts a year to keep up with the permits. Before Measure 50 passed, and many of you may remember, we had a six-year appraisal cycle. So we were required to go to every property every 6 years. That's why the omitted property statutes and the clerical error statutes talk about current year plus 5 years back. We always had the opportunity to fix it. We always had an obligation to show up. I have areas of the county and that due to no permit activity, we have not been there in 20 years. We're out looking at all the properties that have changes. So I don't know if that helps you with your question.
Mr. Chair, follow up?
Please, yeah.
And what is the current standard under Measure 50 in the statute for reassessment? So an addition is made or a substantial improvement or the garage has turned into a bedroom. There are instances, as we've discussed, where realignment of MAB takes place. What's the threshold for that under current law?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Davis. For changes in property, as you described, it's $10,000 in any single year or $25,000 cumulative over a five-year period. Okay. So you could have what's considered a Measure 50 exception event, and if it's under $10,000, it sits out there in a little bucket, which took considerable computer programming to have it watch that little bucket until it hits that threshold. Then it falls off after 5 years.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. That's very helpful. Any other questions on this bill? Thank you, gentlemen, very much. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard today on House Bill 2129? If not, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2129 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2749. Yeah, please. Yeah, that'd be great. Paul, you want to give us a little introduction on this one?
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2749 directs the Department of Revenue to estimate income taxes attributable to net capital gains. There's an annual calculation that's done, and then there's a historical estimate of what the standard deviation would be. And for the amount of revenue that exceeds the standard deviation, for those years in which there's an excess amount of revenue, the excess revenue goes to the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program. under ORS 48.260.
Very good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Tobias Reed from Beaverton, and I want to introduce House Bill 2749, the bill that we started to hear on Thursday, but had a lot of other things going on. I think, as I mentioned then, my longstanding interest in stability in our revenue structure is well known. And so this concept is one that has long been in my mind. It really is motivated by my observation that in the legislature, we seem to often be facing a budget crisis of one sort or another. And because of the volatility in our structure, we seem to alternate between two bad scenarios. In bad economic times, we have to cut. We have to cut very imprecisely. We have to pick between bad options. And in good times, we're often struggling to catch up on the things that we cut or fix the things that have suffered as a result. I don't think it's any fun being on this roller coaster. I suspect you agree with me, and it doesn't serve us or our future very well. So I think we'd all be a lot more interested in asking different questions, like how we reform our structure, how we provide more funding for the things that really matter and contribute to the state, how do we think about design and operate programs and services so that they're right for the decades and the generations to come instead of just how we keep doors open and lights on. So that I think stability is really the key to that question. And what's particularly frustrating about our current situation is because it exists and persists despite the fact that there are things we can do to help it. That's what this bill is about, and it's just one way. I think we all know that one of the most volatile components of our revenue structure is capital gains. Dr. Warner is going to talk, I think, in greater detail about that with some exciting charts and data. And this is just one option. I am not wedded to the standard deviation approach. In fact, I think Dr. Warner is going to talk about another option. And I'm not, though I am a huge supporter and believer in the Oregon Opportunity Grant, I don't think that has to be the only destination for those funds either. In fact, I think we may be doing ourselves an even greater service if we direct those excess funds to the Education Stability Fund that has the constitutional protections, a very specific set of triggers that allow those dollars to be accessed at the right times and in the right amounts. But I think in the end, the key is if we want to adequately fund schools and critical human services and power the growth of the economy and do all the things that we know contributes to the future success of the state, we have to look at ways that we can solve this volatility problem. I think this is one example, and I hope we can figure out a way to make progress on it. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions for Representative Reed? Thank you.
Thank you.
We have one witness who asked to who signed up, and that's Matt Evans. Matt, welcome back.
Thank you. It's great to be back for another exciting Revenue Committee hearing. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Matt Evans. I'm a resident of Raleigh Hills, Oregon. I'm here today representing the Taxpayer Association of Oregon. I have 5 points I'd like to make about this piece of legislation. And the first one is will sound to many of you like an echo from what we talked about last Thursday, which is whether or not such a provision would have an impact on the kicker law. And as I think we concluded on Thursday, that as long as where the money is going is a general fund, there's no impact on the committee, or on the kicker, rather. And Mr. Warner has weighed in on this, although he wasn't definitive. He believes that it does not impact the kicker. One of the things that I think is interesting about this is that it obligates future legislatures, unless they want to go in and make a change in the law, to continue this program. One of the real powers that legislators have, of course, is the power of the purse, is the power to decide how are we going to raise revenue for the things that we think are important and then how are we going to spend that money. This bill seeks to take away, without some additional action, the power of future legislators to decide whether or not the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program is a high priority and simply mandate that money's going to flow into that program. I think you should tread carefully in this kind of an area. And just another point is, you're talking about reducing the amount of revenue that's going to be available to future legislators anytime this higher education kicker, for want of a better descriptor, kicks. That is money that otherwise would flow into the general fund and would be available for the legislature to determine how it would best be spent. In case these dollars will be sliced right off the top and only available as Oregon Opportunity Grant funds for scholarships for higher education. And then just lastly, and this goes, I think, to Representative Reed's interest in stability. I think everybody would agree that stability is a good thing. I think the Taxpayer Association's view of what the word stability means might be different than some in the Legislative Assembly. Stability does not mean it grows every year. Stability means stable. Flat, preferably meeting needs, but with no change in needs, no increase in the amount of money that's available. Capital gains revenue, I think, is well understood, is notoriously volatile in this state. Any effort to estimate it is fraught with peril. Just ask the folks from the Bureau of Economic Analysis here in the state. Is Phil Knight going to sell 100,000 shares of Nike stock this year? Is there going to be some kind of a surprise sale of a privately owned firm that's going to generate a huge capital gains opportunity for the state? Tying the availability of higher education scholarships to the chance that maybe there's going to be a capital gains surprise may not be the wisest policy. Neutral on the bill, but those are my thoughts. Happy to take any questions that might come to mind.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Evans? Thank you, sir. Thank you. Appreciate it. Anyone else want to be heard on this bill today? Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Deanna Mack with Department of Revenue, and I just wanted to point out a couple of technical issues we have, and since we're the ones being asked to do the forecasting, my research section wanted to make sure I got this in the record for you. Right now, we don't do forecasts for the general fund. The Office of Economic Analysis does do that. So we would probably tie to what they do in the May forecast. And because of the timing of this estimate in the current bill, the only data on which we would be able to base the estimate would be April estimated tax payments, which don't typically correlate to capital gains payments. Those are usually, we see them in the December corporate payment and the January personal income tax payment. Additionally, the October 1st date in the bill would also preclude most of the capital gain return information because that comes in October, October 15th. Usually these people file on extension. Additionally, the bill as drafted, they're telling me that it does just apply, it would apply to both corporate and personal income taxpayers. Doesn't specify, it would only be capital gains from personal income tax. Just at a real high level, that's what the kind of technical points they wanted me to share with the committee. With that, I'm available for any questions if you have them.
Very good. Questions for the department? Thank you. That's very helpful. We appreciate it.
You want to look at the charts?
I'm sorry?
You want to look at the go through the charts?
Yeah, please. Let's do ahead. Go ahead and do that.
Okay, Mr. Chair, member of the committee, I have a couple of charts for you. One is, you can divide this into two parts. There's the exciting part is when the blue line is going up. The not so exciting part is as you can see in 2001, and believe me, that was not exciting. And then, of course, we after the dot-com bust in 2000, 2001, again, the stock market takes off. Now, not all of this is associated with the stock market. This is all capital gains income. And probably some of this, since we still don't have really good data to break it out, but some of this was associated with the real estate boom in the mid-2000s. And you can see the peak there at about $10 billion in income in 2006 tax year. And then, of course, the Great Recession hits and the stock market loses about 50% of its value, and we lost about 80% of our capital gains income at that time. And, of course, our revenue fell correspondingly. And you can see now is where we're coming back up again. So the task of trying to project this is very difficult. Back in these days, in the 80s and 90s, we didn't focus on it a lot. But we have, of course, had since tried to do that with this amount of an impact. But we haven't had a lot of success, and because of those kind of swift turns. I did run some simulations to look at some concepts similar to what's in 2749. I couldn't quite emulate it exactly, but if you look at the table there, that's the amount of capital gains, revenue from capital gains, and that is based on an assumed tax rate applied to that income. And this is what we'd be asking Department of Revenue to do in a scheme like this. They would have to make those estimates. And I did kind of have to jerry-rig a straw man in terms of what the forecast was, because there wasn't a formal forecast. And Office of Economic Analysis does do a forecast now, but they don't put it in the publication. So in the later years, we put that in. But I essentially built in a growth rate comparable to what the overall forecast was. You can see that if you look at that first block there, we generally exceeded the capital gains estimates there. Mm-hmm. And the only times were negative were the times in red. And you can see that was the period of the long bull run. So we had the bull stock market, pretty much annual gains. And it wasn't until we got into the 2000s where we really started to see some negatives. And that was in the 2001-03. You can see the drop from 969 to 441 in 2003, 50% drop. We get back up to $1.2 billion in 2005-07, then fall eventually down to 383. So the calculation there in that last column is the standard deviation on the forecast. And the way the bill is drafted now, it has a standard deviation calculation where when you exceeded the standard deviation on the upside, then you'd have a contribution to the Oregon Opportunity Grants. And that standard deviation is 41.2% based on these estimates. So a huge, huge margin of error. Our corporate, where we have a more formal forecast, our standard deviation is about 30%. So that for comparative purposes. Our overall general fund is about 7%. So now if you look at the second block there, I went through and looked at what the revenue would be, and if we could move it over. There we go. You can see the revenue on that last column where we exceeded the one standard deviation. And those would be the biennium when we did that, not in that general kind of period in the bull market when we were getting consistent gains, but we started to see an increase. For example, in 97-99, we had a gain that generated revenue. But the big one was 2005-07, mm-hmm. where we had $293 million. Of course, Matt had mentioned about the kicker, that was the big kicker that year too. So there is a correlation, obviously, between the kicker kicking and when we get lots of revenue from capital gains. But the bottom line is that standard deviation is so large, we end up with only about four biennia where it's triggered, an average of $29 million per biennium. I did go through and look at another option, which instead of being a year, this is based on what I would call a naive forecast that assumes that the forecasters are just going to use last year's actuals for their forecast, which in the case of capital gains probably isn't unreasonable given that there's little knowledge of what direction it'll go. And you can see, again, you get gains consistently, and then you have pretty much, as it's growing, you would be putting more money aside. And if opportunity grants or whatever the particular program was, reserve funds or whatever, and then you would have a larger amount going in over that period, about $130 million on average, with $252 million going in the following the 11-13 biennium. So that would give you a sense if you were just comparing the estimated revenue from capital gains with what you got last biennium. So it would be kind of a naive forecast, and so that way you could calculate the excess that way, and that would be a pretty straightforward way to do it. But as Deanna said, when you're making those estimates, they're always going to be estimates from Department of Revenue or who's ever doing the estimate. You're not going to know those actual numbers for a year and a half after the biennium, really.
Right.
Thank you. I think we should consider this in sort of an opening conversation about this topic.
Although I would just say as a closing, perhaps, to the opening topic, those numbers on the deviation just and the graphic of those spikes just make, to me, the point that we should be putting this money aside since we can't predict it.
Are we with the 41% standard deviation, is that what you said?
Yes.
41%.
That's the biggest one there is in our whole system, isn't it?
Well, it depends on how narrowly you define it, but yes, in the big categories. Also remind the committee about the we got the recommendations from the Pew Research Institute about how to deal with reserve funds. Their recommendation was to find your most volatile revenue components and skim off a portion of it during the good years for reserve funds. So this would be very much a classic candidate for that.
So you skim the high points, mm-hmm. and that puts money available for those low points.
Exactly.
Right.
It gets back, Mr. Chair, to that point of stability.
Stability, right, in between. Great. Thank you. Anything else on this bill today? If not, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2749. See you all tomorrow. Committee is adjourned.